Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Alan G. Lamp, Sr., presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Good morning. This is the time, date, and location established for the hearing in the matter of Dale Horn versus Eric Shinseki, Secretary of Veterans Administration, case number 10-0853. To my immediate right is Judge Davis, and to my immediate left is Judge Schoen, and I'm Judge Lance. Counsel, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Secretary, with me is Karen Washington, Deputy Assistant General Counsel.
Thank you. Mr. Carpenter, who will be speaking on behalf of your client? And how would you like to allocate your 30 minutes?
I would like to reserve 10 minutes, Your
Honor. Make it so. The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Dale Horn. In this case, Your Honor, it is an undisputed fact that Mr. Horn's service entrance examination in October of 1970 failed to note the existence of a pre-existing condition of the left hip.
Ms. Carpenter, what's the present disability of your client?
The disability resulting from the left hip injury?
Leg Perthes?
Yes.
Is the present disability?
Yes.
Okay. Is it the same or worse than it was, to your knowledge?
What time frame?
After the examination.
Well, I presume it's worse, Your Honor. The record's not been developed in that regard,
so
I'm not really sure that
you don't know.
I'm in a position, nor is the court, to make that determination.
The answer is you don't know?
The answer is I do not believe that that information is in the record, Your Honor.
Okay. If you prevail on your position regarding the presumption of soundness, what should the court do regarding the appellant's current seizure disability and the in-service aggravation of the pre-existing seizure disorder?
Leg disorder. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm very confused.
The leg disorder.
Well, I believe this court needs to reverse the decision and direct the board to find that the condition, or excuse me, that Mr. Horn was entitled to the benefit of the presumption of soundness, and based upon that, make a determination as to whether or not he is thereby entitled to service-connected compensation.
Okay. We'll jump right into that then.
Yes.
Why doesn't this case warrant a remand under this court's Douglas case? Would you like me to specify which Douglas I'm referring
well,
to?
Well, I was going through my checklist, please, John.
In that case, there was an Agent Orange-related disability, and the question was whether VA could do an examination to rebut the presumption that he was exposed and the condition was related to Agent Orange.
Well, in my view, Your Honor, this court's already afforded the board that opportunity. This is the second time the matter's been to court. It was remanded previously because the board did not correctly apply the presumption and was told in that remand instruction what the problem was in relationship to the pre-existing condition. I think at some point this court needs to say that the VA has had as many chances as it's going to get to correctly apply the law. The board did not correctly apply the law in the first adjudication, and it has not correctly applied the law in this adjudication.
Well, in other contexts, excuse me, for example, if we find that there's an inadequate medical examination performed, we don't say, oh, well, the board, you had your shot. You know, we're just going to find in favor of the veteran now. We send it back for the agency to correct its error. So why is this situation different?
This situation is different because we're dealing with a specific evidentiary burden on the part of the VA to rebut a statutory presumption. That statutory presumption requires the VA to come forward with evidence that is clear and unmistakable to rebut both prongs of the presumption of soundness. In this case, the VA has not come forward with that, and they have had two opportunities to do that, and I do not believe that there is any further reason to afford them additional opportunity to develop their evidentiary burden. This is not comparable to failing to provide an examination to determine the degree of disability. This is a question of the VA's evidentiary burden to rebut the presumption of soundness. If the presumption of soundness is not rebutted, then Mr. Horn is entitled to the benefit of that presumption.
That was specifically the question addressed in this Douglas case, where it was found that VA had to have the opportunity to do whatever it needed to make the decision. And if in that case it was an examination, then that's what they needed to do. And that was also a question of a rebuttable presumption.
But I think there is a difference in the rebuttable presumption under Agent Orange to make that determination and the circumstance that is presented for each veteran who is entitled to the presumption by statute that their condition upon entry is sound. That presumption should stand unless the VA comes forward with its evidentiary burden. The VA has not come forward on two different opportunities to do so, one with a specific direction from this court by remand. So it seems to me that if the court were to follow Douglas, the court would be affording the VA the benefit of failing to comply with the law not once but twice and be given a third opportunity to do so. And so I believe that would not be consistent with the intent of Congress in providing the presumption of soundness and specifically shifting the burden to the government.
Does the Federal Circuit's decision in Adams assist us in any way here?
The implicit denial decision in Adams?
No, it was a presumption of soundness case that...
I'm sorry, the first one that came to mind was the implicit denial, so I'll take a moment.
I can give you an exact citation. And you can discuss it in rebuttal.
256 F3rd 1318.
And you can get back to me at that point.
Well, I'm not sure since I don't have that and it wasn't part of the briefing giving me additional opportunity in rebuttal. If you could just tell me what the holding is, I would be happy
to address it. Well, in that particular case, the court, our court, had decided to remand to allow a examination to be, I think, redone, or for clarification of examination. And the Federal Circuit affirmed that clarification of the examination because they found a distinction between a clarification and a duty to assist remand.
And again, I think the distinction here is where you have had no attempt at any evidentiary development by the VA on its way up to the board in the first instance, and when the case was decided by the board decided that the presumption had been rebutted based upon inferences in the evidence instead of clear and unmistakable evidence, they were afforded the opportunity to do that on this court's last remand. And I believe that the Adams case would be distinguishable because in that case they were talking about the difference between a duty to assist to provide and a duty to clarify. There is nothing here to clarify. There is nothing in this record. The VA has relied exclusively upon the Service Department records, specifically the MEB report, and the MEB report simply has checked off boxes and doesn't come close to meeting either the statutory requirement for clear and unmistakable evidence or the regulatory requirement for medical principles or a careful, considered analysis of the condition in terms of whether or not there was or wasn't an increase during service. So what we're talking about here is a statutory obligation that is imposed by Congress to the VA to do something evidentially. When the VA does nothing, in the Adams case, apparently they did something, and that something needed to be clarified. Here, what has been done is a net zero, absolutely nothing. And therefore, this court should not consider Adams at all in the disposition of this matter. This matter is about the presumption of soundness. The board in the first case didn't correctly apply the presumption of soundness, was told in a joint motion for remand how to correct that. It went back to the board, and the board did not send it back to the VA for any evidentiary development. It simply said once again, no, there was clear and unmistakable evidence, and that is the question before this court. Is there or isn't there clear and unmistakable evidence to support the VA's evidentiary burden to rebut either prong of the presumption of soundness?
Counselor, for your assistance, the Adams case can be found at 256 Fed 3rd, 1318. Now, let's talk about presumptions, irrebuttable versus rebuttable.
Right.
What you'd like us to do is to turn this presumption of soundness into an irrebuttable presumption.
Absolutely not, John.
All right. Your client was in the military a total of approximately 55 days.
Correct.
Somewhere into about 30 days into the process, the Army convened the MEB board and said, we're not so sure that you met the physical requirements when you were inducted or when you enlisted. I presume that he was inducted based upon the record. So, at that point in time, somebody had an idea that there was a deficiency, a defect, a problem, and that's why this board was put together, convened, yes. So, therefore, putting that in the context of a presumption of soundness, okay, everybody knew that there was a problem. Now, you're dissatisfied with the manner in which it was described and so forth, and the MEB checking boxes and so forth. But it seems to me that that factual context under 635-200 makes a difference in terms of the presumption of soundness. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yes, I do, Your Honor, and I think that that is an incorrect assessment.
Your opinion is that mine is wrong?
Well, I would be reluctant to be quite so bold, but I would respectfully disagree that the presumption of soundness is statutory. Congress says when the military has the opportunity to evaluate at entrance, if something is not noted, then the veteran once accepted into service, and this veteran was accepted into service, and that's an indisputable fact in this case, then the presumption triggers.
Okay, and but at that time, we had AR-635-200 that said within 4 months, if the military decides that possibly there was an error in evaluating the inductee or enlistee at the time of entrance, you have 4 months basically to crank up an MEB, right?
Correct.
All right. So the absolute airlock presumption that you're talking about in this instance doesn't really kick in until entry plus 4 months, right?
That's incorrect, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think Your Honor respectfully is confusing the Army regulations with the VA statutory scheme. This doesn't have anything to do with Army regulations and whether or not the Army's actions in discharging him were correct. Mr. Horn doesn't dispute that. Mr. Horn asserts that he is a qualified veteran who is entitled to the benefit of the presumption, that presumption triggered, and the VA has not met its evidentiary burden. That is a rebuttable presumption, but it requires action by the VA. And what the VA has done here has been nothing. They have done nothing to develop any evidence about the nature of this condition as pre-existing service, and they have done nothing about whether or not this condition had increased in severity when the entrance exam said he was fit for service, and the discharge exam and the MEB board said that he was no longer fit for service, and that's why he was being discharged. That evidences an increase in severity of the condition during service that required discharge. That does not make it a rebuttable presumption. This is clearly a rebuttable presumption, and the legal error here is the fact that the VA, instead of meeting its evidentiary burden, literally sat on its hands and relied exclusively upon what the service department did. And what the service department did in terms of the statutory presumption of soundness was inadequate. And it was inadequate as a matter of law. And instead of developing its own evidence, the VA relied entirely upon, as did the board, the service medical records to rebut that presumption. And those service records are insufficient as a matter of law to meet the statutory requirement for the rebuttal of that presumption, which is that the VA will show by clear and unmistakable evidence both prongs of the statutory presumption, that it preexisted service, and if they meet that standard, then the second prong must be met with equal clear and unmistakable evidence to show that the condition was not aggravated during that period of service. And the VA has done none of that. And that is not an irrebuttable presumption, that is a rebuttable presumption. And the rebutting never took place because the VA took no action in this case. And now they're asking for a get-out-of-jail-free card from this court to say, well, we would like this court not to apply the presumption of soundness as it was written. As written, as interpreted in Wagner, they have a burden. They didn't meet that evidentiary burden.
Mr. Carpenter, why doesn't the Medical Evaluation Board report meet the clear and unmistakable evidentiary burden?
It is not. It is neither clear nor is it unmistakable evidence. This court has defined clear and unmistakable evidence as evidence which is undebatable. There is nothing about having checked those boxes on the MEB report that it existed prior to service and was not aggravated constitutes clear and unmistakable evidence. But more importantly, Your Honor, the VA itself wrote a regulation at 3.304B1 in which it described the type of evidence that was necessary, specifically that for preexistence you could rely upon medical principles. The VA's gone out and got no evidence to say what medical principles would be clear and unmistakable evidence that this condition existed
prior to service. The Secretary's position is that the existence of the MEB report presumes that the VA has done all those things.
Except that, A, the MEB is not the VA, and the medical board, this court cannot presume an action taken when the evidentiary burden required is specified by Congress and interpreted by the VA in regulation. The VA in regulation said, here's what you have to do. If you have a medically accepted principle that you can rely upon, develop that evidence. Get a medical opinion that says this is the type of condition that would naturally have pre-existed condition because the nature of this condition is it's a childhood condition. That would not have been terribly burdensome to get. But they don't want to have to do their duty. They don't want to have to meet their evidentiary burden. They say to you, you presume that the MEB did that for us. That is an irresponsible suggestion in this statutory scheme.
What standard does the MEB operate under?
Preponderance of evidence.
For 200 or for 400? 635.
Well, I think for both, pre-existing and for
For the shortcut exit and
yes.
For the
but I think
PEB
for
process.
Yes.
That's your position.
Yes.
And so you're saying that preponderance of the evidence, if they determine that his condition either pre-existed or was not aggravated, that that was done only at the preponderance level, not at the VA Q standard, so therefore we can't take what they're saying.
Well, you can't permit the VA to inflate that into their statutory standard. They have conceded that what is relied upon is a lesser standard than what Congress imposed upon them. This burden was imposed on Congress on the VA. This has nothing to do with the Army regulations. Even if the Army regulations had been at that level, that isn't their burden, and it would have to be articulated, Your Honor. It's not articulated by checking a box. And when the VA interpreted this presumption of soundness statute at 304A or B1, it gave specific guidelines for how to do that. And one of the things on the aggravation element it said was that medical judgment alone, and at best, that's what we have here, is medical judgment alone that this condition existed prior to service and was not aggravated during service, is not sufficient. There must be a careful consideration of all of the information. And that careful consideration simply does not exist in this record based upon having checked the box.
Why isn't the fact that this MEB report has a doctor on the board at the time anyway, and other professionals, doesn't that give the MEB report some special significance?
No, sir.
And that's your position that you maintained in your supplemental briefing as well, correct?
Yes. It can't have significance, Your Honor, because it's inconsistent with the VA's own regulation. If it were consistent with the VA's regulation, if it had articulated its careful consideration, explained what the basis was for that conclusion, that would have been a different price. See that I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Counsel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have 10 minutes remaining. Counsel for the Secretary.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please the Court, Ronan Morris for the Secretary. Your Honors, the Court should affirm the November 2009 Board decision in which denied entitlement to service connection for left hip disability because, as the Board found, the evidence clearly and unmistakably shows that appellant's leg Perth disease both pre-existed and was not aggravated by service.
How, Counsel? How does the MEB report?
Sorry. Counselor, would you speak up and slow down, please?
Right.
Thank you. Judge Davis.
How does the MEB report reach clear and unmistakable evidence?
Initially, Your Honor, the Board didn't simply rely only on the MEB report as conclusive or dispositive in this case. The Board considered the service records, the post-service treatment records, and appellant's statements. And the Board found that the entirety of the evidence of record indicated that appellant's leg Perth disease pre-existed and was not aggravated by service. With respect to the MEB report, it was certainly proper for the Board to rely on that report. And as Your Honors had noted, the MEB is made up of physicians. In this case, it was three physicians. Those three physicians rendered a unanimous opinion as to both the issue of preexistence and aggravation. With respect to the issue of preexistence, the Board found that appellant served on active duty for a very small period of time, for less than 60 days, that his service records did not indicate any left hip injury or trauma, that his service record shows that he entered service with a childhood history and onset of leg Perth disease. In particular, in October 1970, appellant complained of left hip pain, and at that time he gave a history of leg Perth disease since age 6. After examination, he was diagnosed with leg Perth disease, and the physician determined that it existed prior to service. An October 1970 x-ray indicated that findings consistent with leg Perth disease that existed prior to service. And the MEB confirmed the diagnosis of leg Perth disease and found that it was not aggravated.
So let's accept for a moment that the preexistence is established. No problem. Let's get to the aggravation prong of the presumption of soundness. What evidence is in the record of aggravation, and is that evidence clear and unmistakable?
Well, foremost, there is no evidence of aggravation. To the contrary, the record shows that there was no worsening of appellant's leg Perth disease in service, and the evidence to support this includes the fact that appellant served on active duty for a period of less than 60 days with no indication of any injury or trauma.
Let's back up for a second, counsel. Who has the burden here?
The burden is on the government, but I believe it's...
To do what?
To show by clear and unmistakable evidence that the pre-existing condition was not aggravated by soreness.
Okay.
However, it is relevant in this case that all of the evidence of record shows no aggravation, and there is no evidence of record to undermine that.
All right, let's get to the first part of that. What is the evidence of record that shows no aggravation, other than the MEB report?
Other than the MEB report, there are appellant's statements that the board plausibly interpreted to indicate that his symptomatology had existed prior to service and did not manifest during service. In addition, there's a November 1970 separation examination that the board interpreted and found that it didn't contain any complaints or indication of worsening of appellant's leg girth disease in service. In addition, the post-service treatment records, which the board interpreted and found that there were no complaints until many years after service, and to the extent that they indicated any worsening of his condition, it indicated that it worsened many years after service. When all the evidence is taken in its totality, to include the service records, which again show no aggravation and do include the MEB report's conclusion on the matter, in addition to the separation examination, appellant's statements, and his post-service treatment records, all of the evidence indicates that his condition did not worsen in service.
If we take away the MEB, does the remaining evidence rise to clear and unmistakable evidence?
Secretary submits that it does, and again, it's quite significant in this case that the Secretary recognized that it's his burden to show by clear and unmistakable evidence the lack of aggravation. At the same time, it's quite significant that there is no evidence of aggravation, not even any statements made by appellant to the extent that his condition worsened.
But you're using the lack of aggravation evidence in the record as meeting your burden of showing that there's no aggravation. I think that's a little creative.
No, Your Honor, I'm not intending for it to be considered necessarily substantive evidence of that fact, but it is at the same time not irrelevant that the record contains not even a statement by appellant indicating that his condition worsened or any indication to rebut the totality of the evidence which otherwise shows that the condition was not worsened in service. And again, the Secretary submits that the board did properly rely on the MEB conclusion in this case.
Well, I'd like to talk about the MEB a little bit. What is your position of what the standard is that the MEB reporters have to conclude?
It is the Secretary's understanding that the MEB predicates its findings on a preponderance of the evidence standard, at least in 1970. The Secretary would note that in his response he indicated as much, but at least as of October 2008, the Service Department standards did change to clear and unmistakable evidence. But the Secretary believes that at the time of this MEB report, it was a preponderance of the evidence standard.
So we're working at a lower standard than what VA requires for rebutting the presumption, and we have a check mark and no explanation, no conclusions, no anything. So how much weight is that MEB entitled to?
Like any other piece of evidence, it's entitled to the weight that the board assigns to it. And in this case, Your Honor, I believe that there are several points that support the board's reliance on the MEB report. The first being that this court already has accepted reliance on the adjudicative findings of the service departments to the extent that the service department does make findings with respect to aggravation or pre-existence. It doesn't follow that the board or VA couldn't rely on the underlying medical evaluation board that the physical evaluation board later relies on. But perhaps more importantly, the MEB is a competent medical body. It's made up of physicians, three in this case, three physicians unanimously reached a conclusion that the condition was not aggravated by service. Moreover,
but that's all we know. We don't know why. For an examination to be adequate, wouldn't it require some rationale?
A VA examination, yes, there are regulations and case law which require that VA examinations meet a certain threshold.
Or private examinations with, that VA relies on.
Correct, Your Honor, I apologize. With respect to the transparency. However, there are circumstances and quite significant circumstances and factors that render that should ameliorate the court's concern with respect to the perhaps lack of transparency of the MEB report. And again, another one of those is the fact that it is required to abide by strict guidelines, those or regulations, which have the effect of law on the MEB. Unlike a VA examiner who is given instructions, or unlike a private physician who has no specific mandates, an MEB is required to abide by specific regulatory standards.
I'm sorry, I'm confused, because I thought in your supplemental briefing you said that the MEB wasn't entitled to any special significance or weight or anything than any other piece of medical evidence, but here you're subscribing additional, I would say, weight to a more terse report would deserve if it was from another source.
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not attempting to impute any additional probative weight, but rather to address the court's concerns regarding the lack of transparency. And I believe these circumstances, at the very least, render the MEB report a piece of evidence that the board can assign probative weight to, that the MEB report is not rendered defective simply because it doesn't meet the same types of standards that one might apply to a VA examination or a private physician's report. And again, part of this stems from the fact that the MEB must conduct itself in a certain manner and must reach its conclusions based on accepted medical principles or review of the record. In this case, the MEB indicated that it had done so, and the board also found that it had done so. In addition to the fact that it's made up of three physicians in this case, or at least two in any other case, it's approved by a reviewing authority. That was done in this case. So there was at least four individuals who agreed with unanimous opinion that appellant's condition was not aggravated by service. Further, and to the extent that the court finds it significant, appellant, during the time of service and during the time of this MEB proceeding, had every opportunity to submit his viewpoint, to submit evidence, to appeal the decision, to testify, to have counsel. Appellant had many opportunities to contest these findings, however, he did not. He indicated that he didn't agree with them, but he didn't even so much as offer his personal viewpoint on the matter of aggravation.
Counselor, let me try this one with you, all right? We have presumptions in place in the law. Some are rebuttable, some are irrebuttable. And basically, they're designed jurisprudentially to fill informational or evidentiary gaps. Would you agree with that so far?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, within a few days of entering service, the Army said, under 635-200, we have 4 months to take another look at your entrance exam to see if you really qualify medically for purposes of induction or enlistment, which they did, right?
That's correct.
Inasmuch as they did that, doesn't that tell us anything at all? That there was a suspicion, at least, that this gentleman, Veteran Horn, had some difficulty and that needed to be examined.
Yes, within approximately 3 weeks of the start of his active duty was the first indication of his pre-existing childhood disability, a disability which was otherwise invisible to the naked eye and which the record shows that appellant didn't disclose. He had later disclosed that he had known about this condition since age six. However, and the fact of the matter is that he did enlist into service. He wasn't inducted. He didn't enlist, and he didn't disclose his disability at the time he entered service. 3 weeks, as soon as it was observed that he was having difficulty, the process began, and he was examined, and a medical evaluation board was convened and determined that this pre-existing condition did, in fact, pre-exist, and that it wasn't aggravated by his only several weeks.
Okay, this board is three physicians made up in 1970, right? And then subsequently we have intervening VA regulations and so forth and so on. And here we are today trying to look back 40 years and put this back together. But I guess my real question was, did the secretary have the power to say, let's get an examination and a physician involved at this point today to opine as to whether or not this is a pre-existing condition or otherwise was aggravated by service.
The Secretary did have the authority to do so.
Okay, why didn't we do that then?
The fact that additional evidence may have been helpful or perhaps relevant is not the standard. As the Board addressed in this case, it found that the evidence of record was sufficient for it to make a decision on this claim, and the Board found that there was sufficient evidence to reach that clear and unmistakable evidentiary standard. So in that case, a medical examination was not necessary because, again, the Board interpreted the totality of the evidence, and the clear and unmistakable evidence standards, it requires the Board to look at the record. It is not a requirement with respect to future development, and it doesn't inherently require any type of development. If the record contains sufficient information for the Board to make a decision, that suffices, and in this case, the Board considered the totality of the evidence and found that that evidence in the aggregate showed that appellant's leg prosthesis pre-existed and did not worsen in service.
If we were to assume that this court doesn't find that the evidence was sufficient, then what should the remedy be? Should we reverse following the language in Adams that says this is not a case in which the court's faced with evidence that was clearly insufficient to overcome the presumption, and to remand to allow the DVA to attempt to introduce new evidence sufficient to make up the shortfall? Or should we allow them to develop it under Douglas?
If this court does not agree with the Secretary's position, and if the court finds that the Board's underlying findings were erroneous or that those findings don't rise to a level of clear and unmistakable evidence, it implicitly would be finding that the Board didn't have enough information on which to predicate its conclusion, in which case the proper remedy would be to remand for a medical examination.
How do we work around that language in Adams?
Your Honor, I believe that Douglas would be dispositive in this case because it stands for the premise that the any presumption does not operate to deprive VA or the Board of the opportunity or duty to make a fully informed decision. If the court finds that the Board's findings are unsubstantiated or that its conclusion does not meet the threshold, and the court is implicitly suggesting that the Board did not have an informed basis on which to make the decision.
I understand what Douglas says. I'm just curious how to work around that language in Adams. That's the trouble that I'm having. How do we reconcile these two positions that our court and the Federal Circuit has put ourselves in?
I don't know that I have any better answer other than, again, if the Board is predicating its decision, doesn't have enough information on which to predicate its decision, which is different than poor information or information that may be equivocal, I think that would lend in favor of following Douglas to say that there simply wasn't enough information, and the presumption itself is not enough to inform the Board. It is simply a part of the evidentiary standard. And I apologize that I don't have any further prepared response to that, Your Honor, but would be more than happy to address it in any supplemental pleading.
Counsel, no need to apologize. That's a very candid and fair response. And
it's
a tough question. I admire your response to a tough question. On the one hand, the Board had everything it needed to make its decision. On the other hand, remanding for the Board to get more is your suggestion. And you see that.
I don't believe that they are mutually exclusive because I do believe, or apologize, the Secretary submits that the Board had sufficient evidence both to find that the evidence clearly and unmistakably showed pre-existence and a lack of aggravation. If the court disagrees, the court would be finding that the Board either predicated its finding on erroneous subsidiary findings or that its findings did not rise to the level of clear and unmistakable evidence. So if the court were to conclude in that manner, then it would implicitly be suggesting that the Board did not have sufficient information. And again, the record in this case contains no positive information, positive evidence of aggravation. The only indicia of aggravation stems directly and only from the operation of the presumption, and the presumption does not provide any information to the board on which to make a, which to render a conclusion.
But you've acknowledged and conceded that the burden is on the secretary to, in this instance, correct? And the secretary had the opportunity to develop more evidence and chose not to. How many opportunities should this court give the secretary to fulfill its statutory responsibility?
If Your Honor is pointing towards the prior remand, the prior remand was on the basis of the board's failure to provide an adequate discussion with respect to the evidentiary standards. It was not a remand predicated on a requirement that the board conduct further developments. Right. And in fact, that was nowhere noted in the party's remand.
But as this claim is developed, it's the secretary's duty to develop the evidence. And, you know, you have opportunity in this legal scenario in the realm of veterans law. There are many opportunities which in some ways operates to the disadvantage of the veteran seeking quick justice. So once again, you know, why shouldn't this court, given the, let's assume for a moment at least one of us believes the evidence doesn't rise to the level of clear and unconvincing, why should this case not be reversed under Adams, in fact?
Again, Your Honor, because that leaves the record with nothing but the operation of a presumption. This is an occasion where the board in this case did rely on medical findings, and those findings being the MEB report. The board did rely on the totality of the evidence. There's no indication that the board failed to address any piece of evidence, and none has been pointed to which otherwise undermine any of the board's subsidiary findings. In that case, where the board relied on medical findings, where the board considered the totality of the evidence, where there is no indication in the record to offset the plausibility of any of the board's subsidiary findings, it would not be improper to permit the board to develop the case should the court find that all of those findings, plausible as they are and on their face, do not meet the evidentiary standard of clear and unmistakable evidence. With that said, again, Your Honor, there are a variety of factors which I do, again, believe render the board's reliance on the MEB report proper in this case. And if I understand the court's concerns, the issue is focused mainly on if the court does not accept the propriety of the board's reliance on the MEB report. Not only is it competent evidence as discussed, not only must it operate and abide by the strict regulatory requirements that it base its conclusions on certain principles, but the court, as it expressed in Nieves Rodriguez, it was concerned with the ability of the board to determine whether the medical examiner predicated his or her opinion on essentially a sound medical analysis. That concern is addressed specifically by the fact that the MEB report, MEB was required to do exactly that, and by the fact that it was reviewed and that there were multiple levels and layers of appeal available to appellant had he disagreed with those findings. And while those may not implicate the probative value of the report, certainly they should be deemed to address the court's concern with respect to the transparency of the examination. Moreover, the MEB's conclusions in this case are entirely consistent with the remainder of the evidence. There is no evidence of record, as the board plausibly interpreted, which undermines the MEB's conclusions.
Doesn't that shift the burden, Counselor?
No, and again, I apologize. I was offering that anecdotally with respect to the court's concerns with respect to the transparency of the report,
not the totality of the
evidence. And further, I believe it's worth noting that the VA disability system, as well as the service department's separation, retirement, or severance system, work hand in hand, and they're very complementary to each other, and it does not follow that Congress would permit the Service Department to deny separation pay based on a medical evaluation board's findings, but not VA, strictly in terms of the reliance on that board. While Congress may have implemented different evidentiary standards, there is no reason to believe that an MEB should be relied on only by the Service Department and should be considered some non-evidence by VA when it is the most contemporaneous medical evidence of record.
Well, isn't it possible that there could be an MEB that actually had written findings as opposed to just a checkbox, and that that particular MEB might then be more fulsome and more the kind of document that would inform the board's decision than a checkbox?
The Secretary's understanding is that the MEB form that was used in this case was a standardized form, and that was the form that was prepared by the Service Department.
I think there's some blank space, you know? And I think they are required to state some of their findings.
I believe today that they are. I believe that in 1970, the standard was one that it was presumed that the MEB operated within certain parameters, and a box was provided. An MEB could have included additional information, and you are correct, Your Honor. However, again, there were ample levels of review, ample opportunities to contest those findings, and had appellants appealed, there likely would have been further findings with respect to the MEB's conclusions. In fact, the PEB in this case would have been required to ensure that the MEB had sufficient medical evidence. And again, appellant waived any of those opportunities to contest the MEB's findings. Insofar as the MEB, again, was one piece of evidence, all other evidence supporting the MEB's findings, the MEB being the most contemporaneous medical opinion of record, there is no reason to consider the MEB report to have been non-evidence or to not rise to the level of evidence that the board could properly consider within the totality of the evidence of record. And again, in this case, because the board did consider the totality of the evidence, because the totality of the evidence points solely in the direction of both pre-existence and non-aggravation, that rises to the level of clear and unmistakable evidence, and on that basis, the court should affirm the board's decision. If Your Honors have no further questions...
Ms. Davis?
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Carpenter, you have 10 minutes remaining.
Please, the court, I'd like to start with the question of aggravation in the record, and also to, before I get to the specific items within the service records, to talk about the context here. The context here is that we have a young man who enlisted in service and at age 6 apparently had this condition. There's nothing in the evidence to suggest that after age 6 he had any continuing disabilities or related problems. There is an indication that once in service, he started having problems. And those problems are first noted on the 29th of October, 1970, and at page 234 of the Record of Proceedings, pain is noted. There is another notation from the day before at page 254, which indicates that there has been persistent pain, and he is given medication for that persistent pain. There is a request made for an orthopedic examination that is dated October 23rd, I believe is the date. It's a little hard to read the handwritten writing, and that's at page 256 of the record. And it indicates that there is persistent thigh pain with a history of something. I'm afraid I can't read that. And something about, it looks like symptomatology times 2 weeks with no relief. Now, that is all evidence of aggravation of the pre-existing condition based upon these service medical records. This MEB board was assembled. That was more than 3 weeks into his period of service, and it was a result of his participation in basic training. And obviously, the additional strain on his leg from that basic training aggravated that pre-existing condition. The government stands up here and says there's no evidence of aggravation in the record. That's simply wrong. There are multiple references to aggravation, and when the medical evidence indicated that he had this condition, that was what caused the convening of the MEB board, which is clear evidence of aggravation and contradicts on its face the checking of the box that it was not aggravated during the period of service. Now, this is about whether the government has carried its evidentiary burden. And what is the response of the government to Judge Lance's question about why didn't you get an examination? We didn't think it was necessary. That's a strategic determination on the part of the VA to decide not to develop evidence and to rely exclusively upon the service records and the MEB board findings. And they do so, and this court must hold them to have done so at their own peril. Because relying upon that evidence does not meet and cannot meet, as a matter of law, their evidentiary burden of clear and unmistakable evidence. I have nothing further unless there are any questions from the court.
I have a few. Mr. Carpenter, let's assume for a moment that there is in-service aggravation. That is, the veteran began basic training, the running and carrying 60 pounds was on his back, aggravated his hip, and caused additional pain. Don't we still need some kind of medical nexus opinion regarding the in-service aggravation and the impact on the current disability or then current disability? And how do you obtain anything that will be helpful at this point regarding nexus when we're talking about 40 years ago?
I do not believe you require a nexus opinion. I believe this is a chronic condition and that this condition does not, under 303B and, I just lost the name of it, Federal Circuit case that interpreted that regulation as not requiring a medical nexus opinion when it is a chronic condition. The whole premise here is that this was a pre-existing condition, that he had the same condition in service, and if he has the same condition post-service and there's a resulting disability, and that disability was a result of an aggravation during service, he's entitled to service-connected compensation. There is no need for medical nexus evidence.
But don't you still need to establish that, in fact, some level of aggravation that's connected to his current disability?
No, Your Honor. As Judge Lance correctly pointed out, that's the function of the presumption of soundness, to fill that gap. And it is the VA that has the evidentiary burden to rebut the presumption to show that it was not aggravated. Now, could they have developed evidence to say that this condition, based upon the exertion and basic training, was just the natural progression of this pre-existing condition? Most certainly they could have. But they didn't. And they didn't in the first adjudication, they didn't when they got another bite of the apple, and now they're coming back and saying, well, if you find that this isn't enough, then clearly we need to have another opportunity. No, they don't. They had their opportunity, and they told this court candidly that they made the decision not to get the evidence. And that decision should not be held against Mr. Horn, because they've now decided, after two trips to this court, that the board, in fact, has not correctly applied the presumption of soundness, and that Mr. Horn was entitled to the benefit of the presumption of soundness, and he didn't get it. If he had gotten it, then the VA would have gotten an examination to determine the extent of his current disability and granted him service-connected compensation.
Good. I have no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Anything else?
No.
All right. Thank you very much.
The case is submitted. It will be taken under advisement, and we will now greet counsel.
All rise.